Today is Friday, January 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, ahead of the Lunar New Year holiday, the WHO decides not to declare the novel coronavirus a worldwide public health emergency.
Make no mistake, this is, though, an emergency in China. But it has not yet become a global health emergency. It may yet become one.
Well, that story and a whole lot more coming up next. Chinese authorities on Thursday moved to lock down at least three cities with a combined population of more than 18 million in an unprecedented effort to contain the deadly new virus that has sickened hundreds of people and spread to other parts of the world during the busy Lunar New Year travel period. The open-ended lockdowns are unmatched in size, embracing more people than New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago all put together. Meanwhile, a World Health Organization Emergency Committee has decided against declaring the deadly coronavirus outbreak a public health emergency of international concern. But the committee is urging nations to remain vigilant as the disease, which so far has sickened over 580 people and killed 18, is expected to increase and continue spreading to other countries. Lisa Schlein has that story from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The decision not to declare the coronavirus outbreak a global health threat was not unanimous. Despite 2 days of intense discussions, the expert committee remains deeply divided about the decision. Chair of the Emergency Committee, Didier Hussain, says those in favor of declaring the event a public health emergency noted the increasing number of cases and the severity of the disease as causes for concern.
But several others say that it is too early because of limited number of cases abroad, and also considering the efforts which are presently made by China, Chinese authorities, in order to try to contain the disease.
WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the outbreak poses a very high risk in China, regionally and globally. He urges countries to remain vigilant and take precautionary measures to protect their people from becoming infected.
For the moment, WHO does not recommend any broader restrictions on travel or trade. We recommend exit screening at airports as part of a comprehensive set of containment measures. All countries should have in place measures to detect cases of coronavirus, including at health facilities.
Tedros says there is human-to-human transmission of the virus in China, but for now it appears limited to family groups and health workers caring for infected patients. He says at this time there is no evidence of human-to-human transmission outside China, but he warns that does not mean it will not happen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Rohingya advocacy groups are praising the International Court of Justice's ruling ordering Myanmar to protect the ethnic group from genocide. The ruling comes after Myanmar's leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi argued against Myanmar's genocide, Gambia's genocide claims in front of the judges in December. Mark Vanderwolf has this story.
More than 700,000 people of the Muslim minority Rohingya group have fled Myanmar since 2017, mostly to neighboring Bangladesh. The provisional measures ordered by the court are binding for Myanmar. They include preventing genocidal acts against the Rohingya, preventing military and police from committing genocidal crimes, preserving evidence of crimes, and reporting to the court within 4 months and every 6 months until the case is closed. Cases can only be brought to the court by countries that have signed the Treaty of the International Court of Justice. The Myanmar genocide case was brought to the UN court by the tiny West African country of Gambia. 90% of Gambia's population is Sunni Muslim. The lawsuit was a sign of solidarity and backed by 57 mainly Muslim countries. Myanmar, also called Burma, had argued that the court did not have jurisdiction to proceed with the case. The court rejected that position. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
And joining us on the phone now is Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, Phil Robertson. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Phil, can you kind of unpack the significance of the court's ruling for us?
Well, this is a huge victory for the Rohingya people, for their human rights, and for the cause of justice. It really puts them center stage on the world stage. The court destroyed Myanmar's arguments. The judgment was unanimous, meaning that even the judge that Myanmar appointed to the panel agreed with the plaintiffs. What it's going to force Myanmar to do is take all action to end genocide against the remaining 600,000 Rohingya who remain inside the country. And the priority now is, okay, how are we going to have this implemented? How is there going to be necessary oversight by the international community to ensure that Myanmar complies with this binding order?
Now, if we take a look, you know, during the crackdown, some 700,000 plus Rohingya fled Myanmar's Rakhine state and went into Bangladesh. What's the practical implication for those people who are living in camps, sometimes for years on end?
Well, these provisional orders will compel Myanmar to do certain things inside Rakhine state, which, if they do, will make it perhaps easier for the Rohingya to consider coming back. That means, for instance, ending discrimination, ending restrictions on freedom of movement, allowing access to livelihoods, allowing the international community and humanitarians and other monitors to go into these areas, which have been essentially locked down. All these things will open up the area and perhaps allow for reforms that would make it possible for the Rohingya to eventually return in safety and dignity from Bangladesh.
As you said, this is a binding order, but what are the biggest challenges facing Myanmar and the Rohingya moving forward?
Well, I think that unfortunately, as we've seen from a recent statement from the Myanmar Ministry of Foreign Affairs, there's a sense of denial, I think, by the government and the military in Myanmar that they're going to have to comply with this. They're being very stubborn so far. And so I think that the real priority is going to be making sure that this order is enforced. And in that way, because there's a regular reporting requirement, it will be important for the UN Security Council, for the Human Rights Council, for the UN General Assembly to follow up what Myanmar says they're doing, to check that, and if they're not doing what they're supposed to call them to account.
Phil Robertson is the Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
On day two of their impeachment arguments, Democrats are focusing on what they call President Trump's dangerous abuse of power. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has this update.
This conduct is not America first. It is Donald Trump first.
House impeachment manager Gerald Nadler teed up the session by saying no president has ever abused power like the current one. From there, colleague Sylvia Garcia zeroed in on the president pressuring Ukraine to investigate political foe Joe Biden, saying there's zero evidence Biden or his son did anything improper.
There was no basis.
She says the president wanted it for a reason.
For his own political benefit.
Republicans largely watched impassively, some visibly bored. Trump lawyer Jay Sekulow says focusing on the Bidens was a mistake by Democrats.
I was very surprised.
And he'll start rebutting the case this weekend. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Now to dive deeper into what the Democrats are trying to do during their 3 days of opening arguments, I spoke earlier with Joel Richard Paul, professor at the University of California Hastings College of the Law.
I think that the Democrats are trying to put together a very clear, point-by-point narrative that is intended to show the Republicans why they need specific pieces of evidence. And I think that Representative Schiff yesterday in particular did a really masterful job of kind of stringing together all the pearls and making it very clear where there were gaps and where the senators would want to know more by subpoenaing witnesses and documents from the executive. So I think that that's the strategy they're pursuing. The risk, of course, that they run is that they may be exhausting the patience of members of the Senate.
You say they risk exhausting the patience of the members of the Senate, but don't they have a full 24 hours to make essentially their opening arguments, make their case? Because they're presenting a lot of evidence, as you just mentioned.
Right. And of course, they need the time. I think that it would stretch most people's patience to have to sit there for hours on end without speaking in difficult circumstances. The fact that the Democrats were able to spread that out over 3 days as opposed to two 12-hour days, I think probably helps. And I think what we saw yesterday in the Senate is that a number of senators seem to be wandering around the Senate. Some people walked out of the Senate. They weren't really giving it their full attention. But I think that by the end of the day, the last 45 minutes or so of Representative Schiff's closing statement were so powerful, and he seemed to have the entire Senate's attention at that moment, which I think may be very significant.
The schedule for these opening arguments is essentially 24 hours over 3 days for each side. The Democrats will conclude their opening remarks on Friday. And then on Saturday, the White House has the first of its 8 hours to make its case. And then the Senate breaks on Sunday. Do you think that will either help or hinder the White House's case, given that they could lose momentum between the first and second days of their statements? Or, you know, will it be beneficial because then it gives senators on both sides to go out on Sunday talk shows to talk about the case?
Well, I think that's a really good point, that I think the Sunday talk shows are going to be filled with a lot of people commenting on the case. But the real problem that I think the president's defense team has now is that there will be less attention given to their opening statements on Saturday just by virtue of the fact that people will be doing other things and there's less press coverage. And they don't have that much to say. Their case seems to be a little thin. It might be the case that if they had more evidence and witnesses on their side, they would have a much stronger case. But the argument that they've laid out so far seems to be fairly repetitive, and it's hard to kind of see how that could stretch out to 24 hours.
If we take a look at the Democrats' opening arguments, as we mentioned before, they are presenting a lot of the findings that the House Inquiry Committees uncovered during its investigation. The White House has blocked and prohibited the release of several pieces of information that those committees wanted. Is it beneficial for the White House to either present the information as part of its defense arguments or to just speak to what is already publicly on record?
I think the White House has got to release some sort of evidence, if there's any evidence available, that the president had a broader concern than going after the Bidens. If there's any sign at all that the president actually had a genuine interest in corruption in the Ukraine, they've got to release that evidence, or they've got to have witnesses come forward and say, I met with the president several times, there are multiple memorandum, there was all sorts of activity surrounding this question. If the president and the White House cannot produce that evidence, then I think the Democrats have a solid case on the facts.
That was law professor Joel Richard Paul from the UC Hastings College of the Law. The Trump administration on Thursday ended federal protection for many of the nation's millions of miles of streams, arroyos, and wetlands, a sweeping environmental rollback that could leave the waterways more vulnerable to pollution from development, industry, and farms. The policy change, signed by the heads of the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, narrows the types of waterways that qualify for federal protection under the half-century-old Clean Water Act. Since the first few weeks in office, President Donald Trump has targeted environmental and public health regulations that he says impose unnecessary burdens on businesses. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at Cardiff University in Wales say they have discovered a new type of immune cell that could someday help provide effective therapy that would fight a wide range of cancers. The researchers found that immune cells known as T cells, armed with new receptors called MR1, can find and destroy human cancer cells such as lung, skin, blood, colon, breast, bone, prostate, ovarian, kidney, and cervical cancers while ignoring the body's healthy cells. They were able to show in lab tests that MR1 modified T cells in melanoma patients could not only search and destroy the patient's own cancer cells, but could do the same to cancer cells in other patients. While the researchers admit that there are a number of obstacles to overcome, they say that if testing continues to be successful, it's hoped that this new treatment could be ready for use in a few years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Three American crew members have died when a C-130 Hercules aerial water tanker crashed while battling wildfires in southeastern Australia. The New South Wales Premier confirmed the crash deaths in the state's snowy Monaro region as Australia attempts to deal with an unprecedented fire season that has left a large swath of destruction. Canada-based Coulson Aviation says one of its Lockheed large air tankers was lost after it left the Richmond in New South Wales with fire retardant for a firebombing mission. The tragedy brings the death toll from the blaze to at least 31 since September. Now on the phone from Brisbane, Australia, is reporter James Hyams. James, welcome to the program.
G'day. Thanks for having me.
So what kind of details can you share with us about this crash?
Well, firstly, the whole community here is devastated. The firefighters themselves obviously are fighting day in, day out, 12-hour-long shifts, and fatigue plays a major factor in them making errors. And unfortunately, on this particular day, yesterday, we've lost firefighters. Today, a truck rolled over and six firefighters are now seriously injured in hospital. We don't know the state of them. Obviously, yesterday in the morning, the plane crashed with three very brave American firefighters have lost their lives. At present, we know that there has been an investigation team assigned, but unfortunately, they are not fire experts. They are experts in aviation, and they can't get to that site yet. Perhaps in the next few hours or even tomorrow, they'll be able to approach that site, but at present, they can't even get to the site to inspect the wreckage or to really speculate on what may have happened.
You mentioned that the firefighters are working long hours, 12 hours days. This fire season has gone on for months on end. There's been reporting that if you were to string together the perimeters of all these fires, it would stretch from London to Singapore. What can be done to help them? Is it just a matter of getting more people involved? But what can those in charge do to help those who are bravely fighting the fires?
Well, unfortunately, in this occasion, nothing was done before the season started. Well, that's not entirely accurate. There were measurements put in place, but there were no additional measurements put in place. As the temperatures have soared here and gone over, well, in some cases, 120 degrees Fahrenheit, then obviously the fire danger increases immensely. And the government hasn't taken heed of retired firefighters who raised a series of concerns late last year and suggested actually 10 years ago that the fire seasons are going to be longer, it's going to be hotter, and it's going to be substantially drier. And the government just completely ignored that. The Scott Morrison's government, which is the Liberal Party, they completely ignored the pleas from retired fire chiefs to meet and to go through hazard reduction burns and resources and materials. So unfortunately, there just wasn't enough resources allocated to the firefighters. Now, what's happened as a result of these fires is that people all around the world have been donating money. But unfortunately, that money isn't going to people on the ground yet. So what can be done right now? Well, very little can be done right now. We've got every single fire engine that we can out on the ground. We've got all our volunteer firefighters. We've got more than 2,000 volunteer firefighters on the ground just in New South Wales fighting these fires. So they're doing absolutely everything they possibly can. My wife and I, we signed up to go and fight the fires as well, but unfortunately they just did not have the resources there to assist. So we don't have enough fire engines, for example. And it's pointless having more feet on the ground there than you have resources to be able to put the fires out. So the other part to that is...
James, we're gonna have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. James Hyams is in Brisbane, Australia.
Thank you.
Worries about deepfake videos and artificial intelligence took center stage at this year's World Economic Forum, and an interactive display gave attendees the chance to create their own deepfakes. Reuters reporter Sierra Lee has more.
Artificial intelligence and deepfake video are a major talking point in Davos this year, fueling conversation about overall trust in emerging technologies. This year, the discussions are particularly pertinent in the run-up to the US election, with many asking the question, how can big tech companies stay ahead of fake news and tackle manipulated media?
I'm going to show you just how easy it is to make a deepfake video using technology on show this year. So I'm going to keep my face really neutral and touch the screen so that it registers me. And I can choose to become celebrity from K-pop star Jenny and former British Prime Minister Theresa May. With the touch of a button, I can morph myself into anyone.
Those examples, perhaps not the most convincing, but this one is.
We just want to predict your future behaviors.
The sophisticated manipulation of videos like these, which appear to show Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg saying something he did not, led to a European Union proposal to ban facial recognition use by government. Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai weighed in on the topic and said global regulations, not country-by-country rules, are needed to protect everyone.
AI is no different from climate. You know, you can't get safety by just having one country or a set of countries working on it. You know, you need a global framework to arrive at a safer world there.
Microsoft President Brad Smith believes an all-out ban on facial recognition would have a downside.
I've seen in Brazil, for example, how an NGO is using our facial recognition and working with hospitals, public hospitals, working with police stations, and identifying missing children, in some cases adults who are suffering from mental illness who've gone missing, and these people are being reunited with their families. I don't want to stop that use.
But along with the good comes the potential risk the technology will be misused by governments and private companies alike, leading to some high-tech soul-searching.
That was Reuters reporter Sierra Lee. Nearly a decade after the Fukushima disaster, the Japanese government must decide what to do with the buildup of both treated and contaminated water held in tanks at the site. By 2022, TEPCO says they will run out of space to hold the water. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that story.
At Japan's wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant, workers in protective suits are still removing radioactive material from reactors. Reuters was given exclusive access to the site, where 9 years ago the plant melted down. A massive earthquake and tsunami knocked out the plant's power and cooling. The decommissioning process will likely take decades, but there's a choice Japan must make soon. They must decide what to do with the rows and rows of tanks that hold radioactive and treated wastewater, because they're running out of space. An expert panel last year said there should be two choices. Either let the water evaporate or dilute it, then dump in the ocean. Masato Kino is the official in charge of the water.
If we discharge treated water into the sea and look at it only through a scientific lens without more careful consideration, damage to Fukushima's reputation may happen again. As the government, we have to solve the issue of treated water. Otherwise, it may cause further trouble for people in the fishing industry and here in Fukushima.
This year, Tokyo will host the Olympics. Some events will be less than 60 kilometers from plants, small parts of which are still highly radioactive. TEPCO, which operates the site, says it works to relay information to visitors. Officials say food from Fukushima and fish from waters around it have been tested for contamination and are safe. But the buildup in water has alarmed neighbouring countries. Athletes from at least one country, South Korea, have said they will bring their own radiation detectors and food.
And that was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. Dozens of world leaders gathered in Jerusalem to mark the 75th liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp. World leaders, from U.S. Vice President Mike Pence to Russian President Vladimir Putin, have warned of the dangers of anti-Semitism. Linda Gradstein has that story from Jerusalem.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence spoke emotionally about the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust and the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp.
When soldiers opened the gates of Auschwitz on January 27, 1945, they found 7,000 half-starved, half-naked prisoners, hundreds of boxes of camp records that documented the greatest mass murder in history. Before the war was over, in its 5 years of existence, more than 1.1 million men, women, and children would perish at Auschwitz.
The vice president said the world must never let the Holocaust happen again. An evangelical Christian, he concluded with a prayer, first in English and then in Hebrew.
The memory of the martyrs be enshrined in the hearts of all humanity for all time. May God bless the Jewish people, the state of Israel, the United States, and all the nations gathered here. And may he who creates peace in the heavens create peace for us and for all the world. Osei shalom.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Auschwitz is a symbol of evil to the world.
But for the Jewish people, Auschwitz is more than the ultimate symbol of evil. It is also the ultimate symbol of Jewish powerlessness. It is the culmination of what can happen when our people have no voice, no land, no shield. Today, we have a voice, we have a land, and we have a shield.
He also called on the world to make sure there is never another Holocaust by taking a firm stance against Iran.
I'm concerned that we have yet to see a unified and resolute stance against the most anti-Semitic regime on the planet, a regime that openly seeks to develop nuclear weapons and annihilate the one and only Jewish state. Israel salutes President Trump and Vice President Pence for confronting the tyrants of Tehran that subjugate their own people. The tyrants of Tehran that subjugate their own people and threaten the peace and security of the entire world. They threaten the peace and security of everyone in the Middle East and everyone beyond. I call on all governments to join the vital effort of confronting Iran.
German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier also spoke emotionally, saying he is laden with guilt for Germany's crimes during the Nazi era. Russian President Vladimir Putin touched a nerve when he said that the crimes of the Holocaust were committed not only by the Nazis, but by their henchmen, apparently referring to Poland. The commemoration comes as anti-Semitism is increasing around the world. Moshe Kantor, the president of the World Holocaust Forum, said the situation is dangerous.
Who could imagine that just 75 years after the Holocaust, Jews would again be afraid to walk the streets of Europe wearing Jewish symbols? Who would have imagined that synagogues would be attacked again and cemeteries desecrated and even destroyed on a regular basis?
Israeli officials say they hope that bringing all of these world leaders together will lead to new resolve to fight anti-Semitism around the world. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And finally, Jim Lehrer, the former co-host and later host of the nightly PBS television show NewsHour, has died. He was 85. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, thank you very much for spending your morning with us. You can visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.